Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christy DeLore, covering the completion of Kingston City Council's heat response plan.
The city is making progress on a number of initiatives to protect residents from extreme heat. On February 4th, 2025, Council passed a motion to get the ball rolling on several initiatives geared towards preparing the city for rising temperatures, including setting a maximum temperature for residential rental units and creating a heat response plan. At their Tuesday night meeting, the city's Environment, Infrastructure, and Transportation Policies Committee took a look at the completed community heat response plan, created in collaboration with the Southeast Health Unit. Kingston is experiencing more frequent and intense heat events. According to the plan, by 2050, the number of days over 30 degrees Celsius is projected to rise from 6 to 22 annually, and days over 32 degrees Celsius are expected to increase from 1.2 to 8.3. These conditions not only threaten public health, but also put pressure on city infrastructure and essential services. The Community Heat Response Plan outlines the actions to be taken when Environment and Climate Change Canada issues a heat alert, focusing on mitigating heat-related health risks, especially for vulnerable populations. As for immediate actions outlined in the report, the core focus of the response plan is the establishment and promotion of cooling centers. Upon a heat warning, the city opens designated cooling centers and ensures that all city-funded emergency shelters also serve as cool-down locations. With this being the central focus in the plan, citizens raised concerns about the accessibility of cooling centers. Kingston resident Tara Kaner spoke before the committee and raised concerns about potential barriers to accessing these centers, including transportation, limited hours of operation, and social stigma.
Cooling centers during heat waves are part of the solution, as studies suggest. However, there is little known about who uses them and whether they are effective in reducing heat illness and death. Obstacles to utilizing cooling centers are multiple. My request to you is that you take the time to consider the barriers before you endorse the community heat response plan. Please address the difficulties so that the cooling centers will be effective.
In response, the city's manager of climate leadership, Julie Salter-Keen, noted that the plan will be subject to continuous updates, including looking into what data can be collected while preserving the privacy of those using the centers and offering more public transportation to make the centers more effective. In addition to cooling centers, the city will also be extending public pool hours during heat events and continuing its Keep Cool While It's Hot campaign, which began in 2024 to educate residents about the risks associated with extreme heat and provide guidance on preventing and managing heat-related illnesses. Beyond immediate relief efforts, the heat response plan also outlines longer-term strategies. These include strategic tree planting and green infrastructure to reduce urban heat, enhancing shade and thermal comfort in public areas like parks, playgrounds, schools, and the downtown core, and preparing for poor air quality during heat events, including clean air shelters and masked distribution. Looking ahead, community members also requested updates on progress on other items in the February motion to make the community more climate resilient. Salter-Keen noted that the proposed bylaw amendments required to set a maximum indoor temperature for rental units with AC will be reviewed by the Policy Committee in July. Extending the mandate to buildings that do not currently have air conditioning installed will be dependent on the findings of the City of Toronto, currently investigating the legal viability of applying such a bylaw to all residential units. This is expected to be complete by the end of the year. Councillor Wendy Stephen wrapped up the discussion, noting the comments from residents and what's to come for the city in the next few months.
I just want to acknowledge, Tara made some really good points that there are some actual legit barriers to people using cooling centers. And I think it's worth acknowledging that is definitely true. I think it's also important to acknowledge that the heat response plan is one piece of a bigger picture. I fully agree. It's not sufficient. It's not enough on its own. But I think that this is one piece that is is a step in the right direction, at least in formalizing this. I completely agree. I think that the missing piece is going to be when we hear back about the City of Toronto. And I think that'll really put things in perspective of what we can and can't do so that we can hopefully move forward with some really meaningful action.
The heat response plan will be reviewed annually in partnership with the Southeast Health Unit to ensure it remains effective and up to date. Residents can access current information on heat warnings, cooling center hours and locations, and signs of heat-related illness on the City of Kingston's website. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about unsafe living conditions in the Greater Napanee region.
Thank you, Jesse. The issue of lack of housing for low-income individuals was raised at last week's meeting of the Prince Edward, Lennox, and Addington Social Services Committee. More specifically, the fact that some unscrupulous landlords are charging rent for unsafe, uncompliant living spaces, creating a cycle where vulnerable people have no choice but to live in dangerous conditions. On Thursday, June 12, 2025, Greater Napanee Chief Administrative Officer Matthew Grant addressed the PELASS Committee on behalf of the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee, requesting support in advocating for legislative changes to prevent public funds from supporting unsafe and illegal housing. However, committee members struggled with the notion, suggesting that while removing funding might seem like a solution, it could make vulnerable people's situations even more precarious by leaving them without any housing options. Grant asked PELASS to support Napanee in its effort to approach the province to ask that housing authorities be given the ability to withhold funding from landlords when enforcement agencies like fire or police determine a dwelling is unsafe. Prince Edward County Councillor Brad Neiman acknowledged existing enforcement tools like bylaw and property standards, but agreed that if a landlord receiving public funds is contributing to the problem, the service provider should be taking that money away. In agreement, Grant re-emphasized that public money shouldn't support environments known to be hazardous. Grant proposed a registry of landlords who have documented infractions, and he argued that these units should not qualify for public funds. Committee Chair Sam Branderhorst raised concerns about ripple effects, such as people with mental health challenges being evicted, and stressed the importance of balancing safety and compassion, noting PELASS is well-positioned to help shape those discussions. Branderhorst suggested forming a broader coalition, including Belleville, Hastings, and Loyalists, to work on a comprehensive strategy with fire, bylaw, housing, and social services. Grant welcomed the idea, noted that it would take multiple parties to address the issue. Eventually, the PELASS committee voted in favor of accepting Grant's presentation for information, but made no commitment to join in talks with the province. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LGI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, covering some of this week's key news stories in Gananoque.
Thank you, Dinah. Here is a rundown of some key Gananoque Council decisions from their last meeting. Gananoque Council approved a new private right-of-way at its June 3rd meeting, allowing a legal change of access for several properties previously served off Dempster Drive. The new right-of-way, named Carmel Lane by the Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands, connects to Golf Course Road and crosses municipal boundaries. The change follows approval by the United Counties of Leeds and Grenville, with consent from the four affected landowners. Once registered on title, the previous right-of-way from Dempster Drive will be released, as governed by agreements between the applicant and the property owners. To reflect the updated access, Council endorsed changing the addresses of 821, 31, 41, and 51 Dempster Drive to Carmel Lane. The right-of-way remains privately owned, with no maintenance responsibilities falling to the town. This decision formalizes the private access agreement and ensures 911 agencies are notified of the address changes. At that same meeting, Gananoque Council passed a bylaw authorizing the mayor and clerk to sign a funding agreement with the Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation of Canada for an $11,587.39 grant. The funds will be used to purchase four sets of ice water rescue gear, including Ice Commander suits, personal flotation devices, helmets, lights, knives, rope, and accessories. The new equipment will double the number of firefighters outfitted for full ice water and cold water rescue response from 4 to 8, enhancing the Gananoque Fire Service's ability to respond safely to emergencies on the Gananoque and St. Lawrence Rivers. It will also allow more firefighters to work simultaneously during emergency or training situations. In other business, Council approved a $2,500 community grant to J.C. and James Keller for renovations to the shot put and discus pad at Gananoque Intermediate Secondary School, and they also supported a request from the First People's Performing Arts Festival of the Thousand Islands to display symbolic little shoes on the town hall front steps from September 21st to October 5th.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about Loyalist Township's plan to construct a new skate park and pump track in Amherstview.
At their meeting this week, Loyalist Township Council decided to go ahead with a new skate park and pump track at Loyalist Park in Amherstview. Thanks to a confidential donor, the project will not impact the township's 2025 budget. It will be developed at no cost to the township other than staff time to oversee it. The project will be designed in two phases, with the first to be a standalone amenity with an estimated cost of $500,000. It's estimated that construction will begin this fall, with completion in late spring 2026. Council heard a presentation from New Line Skate Parks, an engineering firm with expertise in skate park and pump track construction. Now with approval, the company will begin a public consultation process that includes youth in the community as well as the general public. Any future operating and maintenance costs associated with the facility will be incorporated into subsequent municipal budgets as part of the standard budget planning process. Phase 2, including completion of the final features in the skate park, would be subject to consideration during future budget talks and would be constructed at a later date. The township's draft Parks and Recreation Master Plan is currently available for public review. Although community members are able to comment on the project, staff noted that to date, no feedback has been received. Vice President and Director of Business Development with New Line Skate Parks, Trevor Morgan, spoke about the benefits of the skate parks and pump tracks they build and the one they're looking to build in Loyalist Township.
Very integrated, green space, connections to pathways, color, texture, art installations. That can be very exciting to put a signature, I guess, of the community within the architecture of the park, even through different lighting schemes, if that's something that's desired. And then accessibility, you're likely to have folks from the adaptive community who would like to ride this park. So yeah, every park has its story, and we hope there's a story to be told here for the township.
Morgan noted the potential boost in tourism the facility could bring.
A network of these parks are being created in communities across Canada and across Ontario, and there's a large population that will want to experience each different unique park and communities, and they'll purposely travel around, stop in these communities, visit, spend money at local businesses, maybe even spend a night. I know when I was 12 years old on a family trip and I was an avid skateboarder, I could be very influential to spend an extra night in a community if they had that one skate park.
Morgan spoke about the potential of events at the facility as well.
You're likely to have user groups and community groups that will say, hey, we would love to have some level of organized events there that could be lessons nights, some community-based contests and so forth. And so we really try to design a modern park with that in mind.
Councillor Paul Proderick spoke about neighboring communities and their skate parks, as well as what a new one in Amherstview could do for the community.
I think the closest one to us is Napanee, and then you go to Picton's got a great site, but again, it's probably 20 years old now. I think it becomes a hub for gathering, and it fits into the master recreation plan. Also, an opportunity to add something to the community, and I think we haven't had a recreational facility addition in well over, I'm going to say, 40 years. And again, it's just through the leadership of a community member who wishes to help out in times where we don't have a lot of money to do a lot of things that we'd like to do.
Councillor Jake Ennis spoke about the donation and choice of the donor.
It's a very generous donation. We're really appreciative to the for the donation, and I think the donor's chosen well. It's a amenity that with an amenity that focuses on youth, and one that I think will be very well used.
Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend showed his appreciation towards the donor, as well as what the project will do for youth in the area.
It's incredibly generous and provides an amazing opportunity for us, and to appreciate the particular kinds of youth that something like this can engage, you know, based on the whole lifestyle and culture that goes with it, not one I claim to understand. I think it's not just, you know, youth engagement writ large in some sort of big broad context. This is something quite specific that I think will cater to members in our community that otherwise don't have a facility like this.
Councillor Carol Parks noted the activity at Napanee's skate park.
I do go by the one in Napanee quite regularly, and it is a gathering place. You see all sorts of demographics and ages and different usage of it, so I fully support this.
Mayor Jim Hagedorn spoke about the progress in access to skateboarding facilities and shared a story from his youth.
I was in my teens on probably a $10 skateboard trying to go down the largest hill where I lived at the time, called Big Hill, and with blind corners. It's come a long way from when I was young. I've actually seen some of the, like MADOC, they have a nice one there. I remember when they were building the first phase, and I was kind of like, what is going on in there? And now to see it now, it's been developed into the whole park is basically devoted to this now, and it's packed all the time. It is something that is what I believe will be well used, and this is a great opportunity, I think, for Loyalist Township to be able to provide another amenity new to the community that will be used, very well used, I believe, for an extended period of time.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the South Shore EcoFest.
Saturday was a perfect day for the first South Shore EcoFest, sponsored by the South Shore Joint Initiative, a dedicated group of 300 people who are passionate about the preservation of the beautiful South Shore of Prince Edward County. The event focused on eco-education, biodiversity, and local marine history. There was something for everyone, including a chance to build a birdhouse, explore the area with a guided nature walk, experience some nighttime wonders in the sky guided by the Astronomical Association, and learn about the Avro-Arrow connection to the county. There was music to enjoy and plenty of kids-related opportunities. Cheryl Anderson, president of the Joint Initiative, gives us an overview of the event and tells us about the group's ongoing initiatives.
We're at the Mariners Park.
And what are we celebrating today?
We're celebrating summer. We're celebrating the great Canadian outdoors, and we've got lots of displays here for people to look at. We've got activities for the kids. They can build a birdhouse. There's a lot of other kids-type things, and people are taking off and going to walk on different walks on the South Shore of Prince Edward County.
Cheryl Anderson, you are on the board here of South Shore Joint Initiative. Can you tell me about that?
The South Shore Joint Initiative started about 7 years ago. We had, a group of us had worked to save the South Shore from industrial development when they wanted to put wind turbines on the South Shore. We were successful in stopping the industrial development in the South Shore, and at that point we decided that we needed all to get together and form an organization that's dedicated to conservation and protection of the South Shore lands and waters, and so we started South Shore Joint Initiative. It's a joint initiative because it's made up of many groups.
What are your initiatives right now?
Right now we're working on 5 different initiatives. The first one was Monarch Point Conservation Reserve. We were successful in having that designated, and we're working now with the government, with the Ministry of Environment, Conservation and Parks, to develop the management plan for Monarch Point Conservation Reserve. That's one thing. Another pillar of what we're working on is a South Shore footpath. We're working to develop a footpath from Point Peter to Prince Edward Point. And then we have number 3, we have cultural heritage. Cultural heritage has 2 prongs. It has a study of the commercial fishery, the 200-year commercial fishery in Prince Edward County. We're collecting documentation, interviews, pictures, videos to get everything into an archive at the Wellington Museum. And also, eventually, we will have an oral history book with some of those stories. Now, today, we're going to have the opportunity for people to hear some of those stories. The other part of cultural heritage is the Hudgeon Log House on Ostrander Point Road. And it has been restored. We've been successfully restored it. And so it's a place for us to do our outdoor education programs and eventually, hopefully, use it as a dark sky place. And then number four is protecting biodiversity. So right now, protecting biodiversity, the Dark Sky Project is part of protecting biodiversity, and we want to get the South Shore designated as a dark sky area. We are also working on a new map for the South Shore so that we have our own map. We have a specialist in GIS work is working on that for us, so that's part of biodiversity. Number five is advocacy, education, and outreach. Education, we have a wonderful outdoor education program. It's run by Cheryl Chapman, and Cheryl works with the schools. She works with the Rock Youth Services. She works at the library. She has so many programs and projects going with young people. It's amazing, and all of that is funded through donations and grants. And outreach is today.
Let's hear what Wild Thing is all about.
Cheryl Chapman, you have a Wild Thing, a South Shore joint initiative that goes into schools. Could you tell me about that?
Yes, we do curriculum-connected programs based on the out-of-doors. We hopefully get the students outside learning if we can. So we'll do field trips to the National Wildlife Area, to the Hudgeon Rose Nature Reserve. But we also go into the classroom and do programs there, interactive nature-related stories with a follow-up activity, just trying to bring awareness of wildlife and green spaces that are here in the county.
Did you know owls have stork-like legs to penetrate the snow when they're hunting? Well, they do. And now, why are we losing our dark sky?
We're the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, Belleville Centre, and we've got about 35 or so members. Across Canada, we have about 4,500 members, and we're amateur astronomers.
So what are you doing here today?
Well, Steve has volunteered our group to put on a little display, public information. We're trying to get a dark sky designation for the area, and that you know, it's difficult basically to convince all the locals and politicians to endeavor into responsible lighting processes. We've got a dark sky, and we're losing it. And it's really too bad that, you know, our next generation won't be able to see the stars, basically the way things are moving.
Why are we losing it?
We're seeing a lot more lighting. Population increase, plus the fact that LEDs are a lot cheaper to run, so people are putting in more lights. And they're putting in lights that shine up and light up the atmosphere. So that's why we can't see the stars anymore.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. It's a smelly and ugly affair at Cobourg Marina as small dead fish appear in the spring. The super sleuths with the town say everything's okay as the alewife fish die after their spawning season. Jennifer Leno with Environmental Services says while it may not be pretty, there is not much concern for public health.
They're like a member of the herring family, so they are typically out in the deep, cold waters of Lake Ontario. They do come to the shoreline, sandy areas to spawn every year. Once they get acclimatized to the warmer water, any wind action or weather events like a rainstorm or anything like that that brings cold water back up to shore affects them. They're already stressed from spawning, coming from the deeper parts of the lake to the shore to spawn. So the change in temperature affects them and they become more stressed, and a lot of them will die off or they become disorientated, so you see them kind of spinning or floating upside down. It's unfortunately a natural part of the life cycle. They're actually not native to Lake Ontario. They're actually from the Atlantic Ocean. They came up through the lakes when the canal systems were built in the late 1800s, so they've been here a long time. They do die off every year. Some years it's worse than others. I remember back in 2014, there was a large die-off, and in 2019 as well, and then this year. So it's not uncommon. It's just not happening to this extent every year.
Do you have any information to indicate why certain years are, I guess there's more deaths in certain years, or they're heavier in certain years than in non-years?
Yeah, I mean, this was a particularly hard winter, so they may have been stressed already. You know, the water temperatures were lower, so them adapting to the change in temperature probably stressed them throughout the winter months. So coming to shore, they were already stressed. Probably did not. They're also competing with other phytoplankton eaters, like zebra mussels and that kind of thing. So over the few years that I've been reading and researching this, is that they're not as, I guess, healthy and abundant as they once were. I guess there is a large population in the 60s and 70s, and when they were spring die-offs, they would have to come with bulldozers and, like, clean the beaches. I was reading one article about Lake Michigan from the 70s, and it was a larger population then, so a larger die-off. And then as the populations have decreased, we're seeing less and less large die-offs unless there's been a hard winter or a prolonged spring melt kind of thing.
So then in terms of, you said the species came in from the ocean
yep.
a while back. They seem to be kind of more invasive now. What's the predation like in terms of maintaining the population? Are you seeing that they're maybe possibly growing more, or is the population possibly stabilizing?
They've been here, well, for over, I guess, 100 years now. So it does go up and down. I mean, predator-prey, it's kind of a predator-prey situation where, you know, there's lake trout and salmon that do eat them. They're like the bait fish for them. So as that population fluctuates, then also the alewife fish population fluctuates. So you will see an up and down, just like any fish population. I don't believe they're going anywhere anytime soon. So next year we might not even realize there's a die-off because it'll be, you know, depending on the winter weather.
Now, other than being an unsightly scene in the corners of the marina mm-hmm. and seeing some dead fish and some debris there,
mm-hmm.
Is there any risk to human health at this point?
No. I mean, nobody obviously is going to be walking in it, hopefully, or, you know, touching it and all of that. Like, Ministry of Natural Resources just advised to, you know, do not directly touch the fish. It's a decaying material, so any decaying material is going to have, you know, higher levels of bacteria. I do go out with the health unit, and we do sample the Victoria Beach every Monday, which we're just starting to do this week, and there has been no adverse effects that we've seen in the water quality. So swimming is okay. You just don't really want to be touching the fish, the dead fish. The town does go along Victoria Beach every morning, and we rake as close as we can, safely can, to the water line to remove what we can that's washed up overnight. We're not really seeing a lot pile up on the shoreline itself because the wave action is taking them back out, and also there's a lot of seagulls that are getting a lot of food from this, so I guess it is considered kind of a natural cycle. The marina and the harbor, they're kind of accumulating because there's no way for them easily to get flushed back out. There's no wave action, so they do accumulate in there when they do come in through the mouth. So
then does that generally, and we're talking the marina now, does that generally kind of get cleaned up by birds, or does the staff kind of have to take care of?
Both, actually. The staff has been going out and skimming to try to maintain the cleanliness there. And there are also seagulls that are cleaning it up as well. And the marina does have a sea bin in the corner of, I guess it's the northwest corner, near the fuel docking there. And it actually works where it will lower below the water and suck the debris into a net, and the staff remove that daily. So it is collecting a lot of the surface debris, not just alefish, but also any, you know, garbage that's in there, that it's collected as well and removed.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, June 19th, we're going to see a daytime high of 23 degrees with some occasional morning rain with a thunderstorm mixed in, dropping down to 13 overnight. Friday, June 20th, nicer day here in the city of Kingston. Partly sunny, less humid, 20 degrees is the daytime high. Saturday, June 21st, just in time for Skeleton Park Arts Fest. Daytime high of 22 in a mix of sun and cloud. And that sun remains steady heading into June 22nd. That's the Sunday for Skeleton Park Arts Fest. Daytime high of 23, but it will be quite humid. Moving into the start of next week. Monday, June 23rd, daytime high of 25 degrees with a high likelihood of a strong afternoon thunder shower, so keep your eye out for that. And Tuesday, June 24th, going to see a decent amount of rain here in the city of Kingston with a daytime high of 24 degrees.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us.